$70 million in ads between Labor Day and Election Day. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 93 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 85 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Africa Now! Today's show features reflecting on the International Day and Decade for People of African Descent. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show, I'm Moise Muntali. The music in the background is Confirmation by Charlie Parker. And we play that commemorating Charlie Parker's birthday, which is August 29. First, I just want to thank all the listeners for supporting Africa Now and WPFW during our recent summer pledge drive. Your support ensures that we continue to cover and connect the issues facing the African world and the rest of the globe. If you miss supporting the show and WPFW, you're welcome to donate at wpfwfm.org. Go to the Donate Now button and you can scroll down to Africa Now and make your support for the station and Africa Now. And again, thanks to all those who supported us, and thanks to all your support throughout the years and hopefully the coming decades. As we have periodically reported on the show, the UN General Assembly proclaimed that from January 1st, 2015 to December 31st, 2024, to be the International Decade for People of African Descent. The decade was one of the outputs of the mechanism developed at the World Conference Against Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance, which took place from the 31st of August to September 8 in 2001 in Durban, South Africa. August is a key month in the UN calendar as it pertains to issues concerning people of African descent. August 31st is the International Day for People of African Descent. This year marks the fourth observance. Also in August, to be specific, on August 2nd, 2021, the UN General Assembly operationalized the Permanent Forum on People of African Descent as, quote, a consultative mechanism for people of African descent and other relevant stakeholders as a platform for improving the safety and quality of life and livelihoods of people of African descent, as well as an advisory body to the Human Rights Council in line with the program of activities for the implementation of the International Decade for People of African Descent and in close coordination with existing mechanisms, close quotes. As noted earlier, the International Decade for People of African Descent ends this year on December 31st. There have been calls for a second decade from 2025 to 2034, as amplified by a group of UN experts, which included Esri Campbell Barr, who is the chairperson of the Permanent Forum on People of African Descent, to take, quote, further action to address systematic discrimination and legacies of the past to bring about the full recognition, justice, and development for people of African descent worldwide, close quote. Today, Dr. Kalanj Hussain joins the show to contextualize the International Day and Decade for People of African Descent, their true meaning, their emergence in global politics and national governments, the role of Pan-Africanist and grassroots movements, the current atmosphere as it pertains to tackling structural discrimination and injustices, affecting people of African descent worldwide, and more. Dr. Clarence Hussein is professor of political science and director of the International Affairs Program at Howard University. Professor Hussein is a member of the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance. He is an author, activist, lecturer, scholar, and journalist. Dr. Hussein is the former co-chair of the Civil Society Committee for the U.S.-Brazil Joint Action Plan to Eliminate Racial Discrimination. Professor Hussein has offered books such as $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman, and The Ongoing Struggle for Racial Justice and Democracy, The Black History of the White House, Hitler's Black Victims, The Experiences of Afro-Germans, Africans, Afro-Europeans, and African-Americans during the Nazi era, and more. Here is the recent conversation with Dr. Hussein, contextualizing the International Day and Decade for People of African Descent. Professor Clarence Hussein, welcome to the show. I should say welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's always good to be on with you, of course.
Great to talk to you about these issues that pertain to the people of African descent. First, I just want to go into the background of the International Day and also the International Decade for People of African Descent. What led up to these developments?
So if I can, let me give a little bit of a historical background that will bring us up to date. So, of course, there has always been efforts by people of African descent around the world to connect, to work together, to fight for justice together, to exchange experiences. And sometimes that's been through formal organizations by people of African descent, but it's also been through organizations that have existed kind of outside of those boundaries. But that have been useful, one of which is the United Nations. So during the Cold War, the United Nations was in fact a barrier to global Black unity, in part because of the split in the global community between, on the one hand, the West, centered by the United States, and the East, centered by the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union ended, that opened up opportunities, including at the United Nations, that no longer was bounded or circumscribed by Cold War politics. And so African Americans and other groups were able to then use the United Nations in a very different kind of way. One notable point was the World Conference Against Racism in 2001. Prior to that, there had been a couple of conferences. They were called World Conferences, but again, they had been shaped and limited by the Cold War. So really, the gathering in 2001 in Durban, South Africa, was really the first time that you really, through the mechanisms of the United Nations, brought together thousands of people of African descent, not only on the continent, but from Asia, from Latin America, from the United States, from the Caribbean, and from Europe. And coming with a broad focus on issues around race that not only included people of African descent, but other communities as well. Coming out of that gathering from the which was a combination of civil society and governments who met, and coming out of that, there was an official what was known as the Durban Declaration, which was a statement of objectives and purpose and meaning on the gathering, also coming out of that was a program of action, that it wasn't just let's declare that we need to address these issues, but let's do something. So all of that's a long way saying that out of that program of action it initiated a couple of important bodies, one of which was the Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent. And this was supposed to be a mechanism that would hold the United Nations essentially accountable to some of the commitments that had come out of Durban. 20 years later, essentially the 20th anniversary of the Durban Conference, the UN General Assembly launched the International Decade of People of African Descent, part of which was the International Day of People of African Descent. And again, this was to further the objectives and goals that came out of Durban.
Yeah, the official declaration of the International International Day for People of African Descent was on August 31st on 2021, exactly 20 years after Durban. As you said, this was part of the UN mechanism, but in the spirit of Black August and in the spirit of liberation experience of people of African descent, there has been the role of folks outside the officialdom with the Pan-African Congress and Pan-African conferences and people like Du Bois and Patterson forcing the UN to deal with this issue. And even before the UN was established, for the international community to focus on issues concerning people, African peoples, as you noted.
No, so you raise a really important point, because in the past, the efforts at bringing together people of African descent globally operated also through particular frameworks, Pan-Africanism being one of the central efforts at that. And both through W.B. Du Bois, as you noted, and the Pan-African Congresses, which met in a number of different countries in Europe, beginning in 1919, putting pressure on these essentially global, mostly European bodies to not ignore the demands and the issues and concerns of people of African descent and other people around the world. And so Du Bois attempted to do that through the Pan-African Congresses that met in France, they met in the UK, they met in a number of different European countries. Over the 20s and 30s, once in the 1940s, and then without Du Bois, they met again in the 1970s. And parallel to what Du Bois was doing was Marcus Garvey and the Garvey movement, which again, through the framework of Pan-Africanism, sought to build the movement, the United Negro Improvement Association, as a global effort. And so from pretty much 1915 up until through the 1920s, until Garvey was arrested and sent to prison, that movement grew probably into the millions and in dozens of countries around the world. So there's that legacy and that history that's there. There were other efforts, principally by leftist and communist organizations, to do similar kinds of gathering. Now, all that's important because the United Nations is not a Pan-Africanist organization. It is not a leftist organization, so it doesn't bring those frameworks to this effort. They are Pan-Africanists who have been active both with the Permanent Forum on People of African Descent as well as the Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent. But again, those are not Pan-Africanist organizations or even entities.
Yeah, we also have to remember these are the framework of officialdom, the UN right. officialdom of with the governments, and but which clearly have been pushed by the grassroots. And thinking about that and the grassroots movement, have these as we mark these days and a decade, has it permeated within the grassroots movement? Do grassroots movements see these as watered down version of the struggle?
So there are these efforts are pretty elite, if I may, in the sense that they absolutely do operate kind of at a rooftop level. Most people in the world do not think of United Nations on a day-to-day level. There are places that do, where the United Nations is playing a role in people's livelihood, whether it's in refugee situations or stopping war kind of situations. But for the most part, the UN is an abstraction for people. That doesn't mean it's not important, but its importance to people in grassroots communities is pretty marginal at best. Now, there's been a serious effort by those activists who have understood the importance of bodies like the United Nations, from W.E.B. Du Bois to Malcolm X to many others who want to use any forum that's available as a way to raise issues and push the movement forward. So that, I think, has been the goal and objective of people who have operated in these particular bodies. I speak from personal experience working on a commission in Europe that even most people in Europe never heard of, let alone people in the United States. But its links and connections with those who are in power and the degree to which that power has to be engaged and challenged, I think makes it important that there are people of African descent, conscious and progressive people of African descent who do work with and have a place in these bodies and raise criticism as necessary. So people who are part of the permanent forum on people of African descent, as well as the working group of experts, have been some of the most vocal in criticizing the limits and obstacles of working through the United Nations, even as they attempt to try to do so.
Speaking of the Committee of Experts, would you say one of its achievements was the establishment of the UN Permanent Forum on People of African Descent 3 years ago in August 2021. Do you see it as one of the achievements, or lack of a better word, that the Committee of Experts has had?
So what the committee has done, they go by the group of experts, their various titles. But what they have tried to do, which I think has been important, is to hold states accountable for their actions. So part of that has been annual meetings, sometimes more than once a year, where they will use those forums to call out the lack of progress on the Durban Declaration and the Durban Program of Action, to not let those just kind of falter. That, you know, the people coming together again in the thousands was an important historic point, and we should not just let it go out of government inertia. So they've attempted to do that. The people who are on the permanent forum, I know several of them, in their own rights are very active. Justin Hansforth, for example, who's a law professor over at Howard University's School of Law, who's a member, has had a number of events. He works with students. He's taken students to Geneva. So he's played, just kind of a tireless role. S.V. Campbell, who was elected official in Costa Rica, first Black woman. She's been active not only in Costa Rica, but throughout the entire region. So, you know, individually, you have people who are really, really on the front line and are not just kind of sitting in rooms debating these issues, but trying to find ways to be active. During the International Decade for People of African Descent, there have been dozens and dozens of events around the world to commemorate the decade, particularly focused on like reparations, racial justice, development, and inclusion. So those have really been kind of the focus, again, with limited capacities. And while you know, they've outreached to, you know, some communities, you know, clearly is just not enough. And again, most communities simply have never heard of the permanent form.
Again, that's Dr. Clarence Hussain. He is professor of political science and director of international affairs program at Howard University. And he's also a member of the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance. And we're reflecting on the International Day and Decade for People of African Descent. As we were talking about the some of the limitations of the workings of the committees in the UN, there's also the historic ambivalence, or rather, one would say outright hampering of some of the objectives of the Durban Declaration, for instance, and beyond, especially since we're sitting here in the U.S., in the United States. Countries like the U.S., they have the historic ambivalence of dealing with racial issues. If you could highlight particularly in the workings of the structure that was put into place more concretely after Durban.
Yeah, so it's been really challenging to get some movement. Now, just again, to give a little bit of context, as the Durban conference was ending, and for all of its issues, both at the government level and in civil society, coming out of that, there had been an agreement on the declaration and on the program of action. However, within a couple of days of the conference coming to an end is when September 11th happened. And as a consequence of that, it not only drew energy and momentum away from the Durban conference, but it also saw a major shift in Western countries, including the United States, that began to target the developing world through an anti-terrorism lens. And George W. Bush had become president during the buildup, and then by the time the conference happened, he was the president of the United States. And there had been an effort to have the U.S. involved, particularly working with Colin Powell, former Secretary of State Colin Powell, who was a Black American. But the U.S. pulled out. So coming out of Durban, the U.S. was already kind of on the outside. And that would go on basically for years. When Obama became president, there was some space that opened up, and that allowed for the U.S. more generally to engage the United Nations and other international forums, but also open up some doors for activists that had not been there before. But again, the U.S. kind of comes into this whole process in a very janky kind of way. And other countries essentially went down the same roads. A few countries that were engaging were places like the UK, for example, Japan. You know, there were a few places where people who attended Durham followed up and continued, but it was really, really kind of challenging. So all of that to say is that then when these other mechanisms get put in place, the permanent forum and the working group, it's in the context of really a ground up kind of battle, because at the top in many of these countries, and again, the US in particular, there was just kind of no openings or no, there was, it was a very unfriendly kind of environment.
I guess one would not expect much more, considering that the system is one that is built on enslavement and colonization. So that would be a tremendous struggle against these countries that have benefited from that to forcefully deal with this issue.
No, that's exactly right. So one of the central issues that the U.S. claimed for why it pulled out, but was absolutely core, was reparations. And there was no backing down by people at Durban. And since then, that reparations still requires a acknowledgement on the part of countries that participated in slavery, the slave trade, colonialism, and repair. That repair has to be any part of any serious engagement moving forward. So that is, you know, basically another sticking point. And as of this date, you still don't have any of these countries that are committed to reparations in any of these Western countries in any serious kind of way, whether it's France and, you know, its long history, but also its, you know, engagement with Haiti up until now, or the UK and the role that it played, Germany and its role in colonializing and dividing up Africa. You know, all of these states have not seriously got to the, again, core of what had been argued at Durban and continues to be a focus of the forum and the working group, which is reparations.
And I was just thinking about, as you're talking about that, I was just thinking about how the climate was, as you mentioned early on, right after Durban, the issue of using terrorism as a big issue in the context of world diplomacy, that was George Bush used to say, "You're with us or against us," in that context. Yeah, and then we fast forward to the present day. Particularly in light of 2020, the year of the George Floyd murder, and then also the role of COVID, how did that impact some of the gains and also maybe some of also the constraints on the mechanisms of the UN Permanent Forum and people for people of African descent, as well as looking at the International Decade for people of African descent, as well as the International Day for people of descent?
So within that International Decade from 2014 or 2015 to 2024, you have a number of cataclysmic events that happen that impact the degree to which this decade can actually go forward. So one, you have the election of Donald Trump and the way in which his rightward shift of U.S. politics permeates not only through the U.S., but through the global community. Then you have the COVID pandemic, and not only it's global devastation, but the disproportionality of its impact, and particularly on developing countries particularly on working class and poor people within Western countries. You have all of that evolve. And then you have the murder of George Floyd, which travels internationally. And I'm not sure how much people here really get the degree to which that was a catalyst for activism globally. For example, in Guinea, in Papua New Guinea, where you had minority communities who had been oppressed and marginalized for decades, they saw themselves in the Black Lives Matter moment. Throughout all of Europe, whether it was Germany, whether it was Spain, whether it was France, whether it was Luxembourg, whether it was all these countries, you had Black Lives Matter expressions. In Asia, in Central America. So all of that kind of came together for a decade of really kind of astonishing events, right? So the international efforts to continue the progress of people of African descent, the networking, the raising of issues, the mobilizing and organizing, has to be contextualized within, you know, those really kind of moments as well. But through all of that, the steadfastness of calling for reparations, calling for accountability, calling for justice, did not waver.
You're listening to a conversation with Dr. Clarence Hussain, in which he contextualizes the International Day and Decade for People of African Descent, their true meaning, the emergence in global politics and national governments, the role of Pan-Africanist and grassroots movements, the current atmosphere as it pertains to tackling structural discrimination and injustices affecting people of African descent worldwide, and more. Dr. Clarence Hussain is professor of political science and director of international affairs program at Howard University. He is also a member of the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance. The music in the background is Elmina by Kofi. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation. And we see that calling for reparations, as you mentioned, we see that it's in action today, particularly in the Caribbean region, which in the past wasn't necessarily the leading countries in terms of reparations. It tended to be coming from the U.S. If you could elaborate on that.
I think you're right. So through the Caribbean, through places like Barbados, Jamaica, other states, or activists in these states, and in some instances, people in leadership in these states, have been some of the most vocal and active around reparations. For example, hosting meetings in some of these countries, or raising these issues in the UN General Assembly. And you're right that core of reparations, particularly coming out of that history we talked about earlier with Du Bois and Garvey, located it a lot in the U.S. It had minimum sort of resonance in Africa, but it has been picked up. And I would argue that in significant ways, a lot of the center, at least in terms of a global effort, really is coming out of some of these Caribbean activists.
And again, that's Professor Clarence Hussain. He is the political science professor and Director of the International Affairs Program at Howard University, and is a member of the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance. We're reflecting on the International Day and International Decade for People of African Descent. I wanted to backtrack a bit to give some context. You mentioned the presidency of Trump. That was also at the same time, right before, that was the Brexit movement in the UK. People saw it as an economic struggle in the UK, but really it was more against immigrants. In a way, it was used as the EU was used as a Trojan horse. Could you elaborate how this has affected or exacerbated racism in Europe today, especially looking at the emergence of the right-wing movements picking up steam in Europe?
So the far right in Europe never has went away, and has been had been for a long time on the outs of electoral politics. So if you look at the 1980s and 1990s, the far right were basically gangsters and thugs who beat up people on the street and you know, committed all kinds of crimes, but they had disdain for electoral politics. But that began to change towards the end of the 90s and early 2000s from the movement in France with Le Pen to once Germany united, and you had the far-right forces that have been in Western Germany begin to unite with the far-right forces that have been underground in Eastern Germany, kind of all that comes together. And you see it in Greece. You see it in a number of different places where there's this shift now towards electoral politics. So in the UK, there's a new far-right organization that emerges, UKIP, the United Kingdom's Independent Party. And different from the other far-right forces, it shifts its focus to electoral politics. It gets a number of its members elected to the European Parliament. But most critical, it, as you point out, takes on the nationalist framework of the EU is evil, the UK needs to get out, and the way we should, the way we can build the case for that is through racialization of migrants and immigration. And so you look at the ads, you look at the way in which they promoted Brexit, the getting out of the EU, it was all centered around essentially what Donald Trump is doing of demonizing, dehumanizing, and racializing immigrants. And so they pulled that off, and they didn't come to power, but what they did do, and this happened in other places, so in the Netherlands and in Hungary and in Italy and in Greece and in Germany, a number of countries, you had these far-right parties that a generation earlier would have been pro-screaming and shouting, running and winning elections. And again, this makes it extremely difficult for communities like people of African descent to advance, because the atmosphere and the dynamic has really kind of spoiled itself and went in a direction away from sort of the historic social democracy kind of tenor that existed in some of these countries.
And we see that rearing its ugly head again this year. I mean, recently in the UK, in England specifically, where there was the stabbings of some children, and I think it was three people who were killed, and then there was misinformation about who did it, and it was really that the people who spread the misinformation was saying that this was an immigrant who was who had come in on the boats and right. Was a refugee and actually there's nothing to that to that information. It was all that this person was actually born in the UK of a Rwandese first parentage, and because they also used right. anti-Islamic message that he was actually Christian. So you see that the atmosphere is still, and you see that of course in the United States, but we're looking at other regions. We're looking at the Europe, where you do a lot of work, of course, and as well as in South America and Brazil, for instance, with the Bolsonaro, right. because he also comes on the scene around right. the same time as Trump, right. and if we could kind of elaborate a bit on that and how that is also a factor in this workings of people trying to raise the issues of people of African descent and the struggles of people of African descent worldwide.
Yep. So, just a quick detour back to Europe for a minute. So the far right has been gaining. So it may not look like that with the UK elections and the French elections, but in the UK, it wasn't as much that the Labour Party gained. It was really that people moved away from the Conservative Party. So that Conservative politics did not shift. It just was tired of the Conservative Party itself. And in France, Macron was saved because there was the left that came together, but it's a disjointed left. And there's a big question of whether or not Marine Le Pen will win in the next election, because they absolutely do have momentum, again, even with losing kind of overall. In Brazil, Bolsonaro takes advantage of, similar to some of these other far-right forces, of Christian nationalism. And there have been a very strong and growing evangelical movement in Brazil, going back to the 1990s, picking up in the 2000s. They were central to getting rid of President Lula, the first time they were mobilized. And Bolsonaro kind of took advantage of that. What's important about that is it actually crosses racial lines. So even though I would argue the core is really a white Christian nationalism, the same in the U.S., but you have Black people who have aligned themselves with that movement. And so in Brazil, overwhelmingly, Black community goes with Lula, but Bolsonaro and the far right, through the Christian nationalist vehicle, have support. And as a result, Lula 2.0 is weaker than the first time Lula was in power, in part because the far right in the Brazilian government has grown. So we're seeing that in a number of places around the world. In Latin America, in Europe, and in Africa itself. So, you know, I'm concerned with the degree to which we don't take up as much how this Christian nationalist ideology really has a hold on many people and becomes a Trojan horse, kind of a back door for this white supremacist framing.
In that context, how do you see the election in Colombia of Gustavo Petro for president and Francia Márquez as the first Black woman vice president? How do you see that affecting Brazil and the rest of South America?
So Colombia is really important, I think, in this, because it does kind of stand outside of the trend. And not only in terms of kind of politics in general, but the activism and sophistication and engagement of Afro-Colombians in both electoral politics as well as kind of grassroots politics. And so not only the sister, but the ambassador to the United States, right? And these are progressive African, progressive Afro-Colombians who are also reaching out to other parts of Latin America. And so I see them as really, really key in what has really been a struggle. There have been a bunch of starts and stops at bringing together Afro-Latinos, going back to at least the 1980s that I know of. But those have been really, really difficult efforts, in part because basically there have been no governments that were given any kind of support outside of like maybe Cuba or somewhere. But for most of the countries in Latin America, you know, it was basically white-run governments who marginalized their Black communities and just made it just almost impossible. But people have continued to try to kind of get around that. And I think Colombia can really, really be kind of critical on that. Brazil, too, because Lula, once he got back, when Lula was taken out of power, much of what he was trying to do around inclusion of Afro-Brazilians was, of course, thrown out the window by Bolsonaro. But now that he's back in power, there's been an effort both by his government to reignite some of those initiatives with resistance from the national parliament, but also linking up with Black community leaders in Brazil. So you can see some of this effort, but it's a challenge. And there are places all over the region, from Guyana to other places, where there's kind of a deterioration of relations around race. And so it's hard to kind of see where all that's going to end up.
On that note, we come to as we come to the end of our discussion, what would you say why it's important to have the International Day and the International Decade for People of African Descent, and what can be done on a day-to-day basis by grassroots movements and citizens as well?
So I think it's one of the questions is, with the decade coming to an end, kind of what happens next? And I think from what I gather, people who are part of the Permanent Forum as well as the working group are wrestling with these questions in the context of wrestling with where does the United Nations go. Clearly, though, whatever happens, the United Nations is not going to be the liberating force for people kind of on the ground. So that still requires very serious local organizing, local engagement on all these immediate issues that people are facing, but also recognizing the national and global nature. And so the challenge is to have those linkages. I think there's a willingness, the capacities and resources and skills to do that are going to be challenging. But if the willingness is there, I think we can find a way so that the housing issues I have in DC will be linked with the housing issues people have in Cape Town and that they have in Brixton, right? And so to the degree that, you know, we think in these overlayered, I think it's helpful. So in that context, then, the International Day is a point where this can be highlighted and these issues can have a forum. They can have a boldface and underscore as we kind of continue this work we do locally.
Clarence, thanks again for being on this show, and look forward to continue unpacking this issue.
Thank you so much. I absolutely enjoyed our conversation.
You've just been listening to a recent conversation with Dr. Clarence Hussein, in which he contextualizes the International Day for People of African Descent, which is August 31st, and also the International Decade for People of African Descent, which is from January 1st, 2015 to December 31st, 2024. The conversation looked at the International Day and Decade for People of African Descent, looking at their true meaning, their emergence in global politics and national governments, the role of Pan-Africanist and grassroots movements, the current atmosphere as it pertains to tackling structural discrimination and injustices affecting people of African descent worldwide, and more. Dr. Clarence Hussein is Professor of Political Science and Director of the International Affairs Program at Howard University. He is also a member of the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance. He is an author, activist, scholar, lecturer, and journalist. Dr. Hussein is the former co-chair of the Civil Society Committee for the U.S.-Brazil Joint Action Plan to Eliminate Racial Discrimination. Professor Hussein has also authored a number of books, such as $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman, and the Ongoing Struggle for Racial Justice and Democracy, The Black History of the White House, Hitler's Black Victims, and more. You can revisit this conversation on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Africa by Alice Coltrane, commemorating her birthday, which is August 27th. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muizam Tali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shanana with Zain Al-Amin, looking at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, particularly the plight of Palestinians. And that's followed by Sophie's Parlor, the Women's Collective, which is followed by Human Rights and Justice with Nikichi Taifa. And that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Compete Lakai with Eugenia Charles, looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers Michael Nasella and Kalia Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Kozer and Funangonda, and our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan-Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Oderson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW. And thank you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. And as I mentioned before, if you were not able to donate during our summer pledge drive, you can still show your support at WPFWFM.org. Go to the Donate Now button, or you can also go to our Cash App, which is the $WPFWFM, and include your email address on Cash App so we can acknowledge you properly. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Quilombo O El Dorado Negro by Gilberto Gil. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
Liberdade pro todos regaram com todas as águas do pranto, quilombo. E todos tiveram de tombar a mão e lutando, quilombo. E todos nós ainda hoje desejamos tanto.
Existiu o Eldorado negro do Brasil.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. The Israeli military launched a large offensive in the occupied West Bank last night, killing at least 10 militants and sealing off the city of Jenin. Israeli forces have stepped up operations in the West Bank since the war in Gaza began last October, but last night's offensive was one of the largest in months. An Israeli military spokesperson said the offensive was only the first stage in an even larger operation. The governor of Jenin said on Palestinian radio that Israeli troops had blocked access to hospitals and torn up infrastructure in the city. Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz compared the West Bank to Gaza, saying operations in the West Bank should include, quote, the temporary evacuation of Palestinian residents. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas called last night's offensive a, quote, serious escalation, while Hamas called on Palestinians in the West Bank to, quote, join the sacred battle of our people. Mexican President López Obrador told reporters today that he put relations with the U.S. and Canadian embassies, quote, on pause, but did not provide details on what that meant. The ordered pause comes after the U.S. and Canada both critiqued a proposed judicial overhaul in Mexico that would, in part, require judges to stand for election. That overhaul has faced sustained protests from federal court workers and judges. Critics of the overhaul say it threatens judicial independence and expertise and could harm merit-based pay and promotions for court workers. U.S. Ambassador Ken Salazar last week said the proposal could harm trade between the U.S. and Mexico. López Obrador and his ally, President-elect Claudia Sheinbaum, have defended the proposed overhaul. In domestic news, the U.S. Department of Justice filed a revised indictment against Donald Trump yesterday over his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. The revised indictment, brought by DOJ Special Counsel Jack Smith, does not substantially change the criminal case against him, but rather aims to protect it after a Supreme Court ruling in July saying Trump and other presidents have immunity for official acts while in office. The document retains the same four criminal charges, but portions are rewritten to emphasize that Trump was not acting in an official capacity when he tried to overturn the election. Rather, the document says Trump was acting as a candidate seeking political office. If the case goes to trial, a trial won't happen until after the election. And if Trump wins the election in November, he could ask the Justice Department to dismiss the case. A man prosecutors say was the first rioter to enter the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, 3 years ago, was sentenced yesterday to more than 4 years in prison. A federal judge in March found Kentucky resident Michael Sparks guilty of several counts, including felony obstruction of an official proceeding and civil disorder. During his sentencing hearing, Sparks told the judge he still believes in false theories that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump. And Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris and her running mate Tim Walz are launching a two-day bus tour through Georgia today that will wind through traditional Republican strongholds and rural areas before ending in a large rally in Savannah. Georgia is a key swing state in the November presidential election. Democrat Joe Biden won the state by less than 12,000 votes 4 years ago, and the Democratic Party believes it needs to chip away at GOP support in order to win the state again. In addition to their bus tour, Harris and Walz will be sitting for their first joint interview to be aired on CNN tomorrow night. The Harris campaign also launched an advertising blitz across swing states, hoping to tie her opponent, Trump, to the conservative Project 2025 plan. The Harris campaign is spending $370 million in ads between Labor Day and Election Day.